Campus FM presents a talk organized by Flimkien Alambian Tahyar, entitled Air Pollution and Its Effect on Human Health.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and thank you for coming to our lecture this evening. Welcome to tonight's discussion on the effect of air pollution on human health. We will begin with a short, and I was asked to emphasize short, presentation by Dr. George DeBono, followed by a lecture by Ms. Catherine Witherspoon, and end with a discussion session. Our event tonight was made possible through the cooperative efforts of Flimkien Gal Ambient IR and the United States Embassy, as well as Ms. Catherine Witherspoon and Dr. George DeBono. It is my great pleasure at this time to introduce Dr. DeBono. He's one of the founding members of Flimkien Gal Ambient IR. He's going to begin the evening with a brief presentation on local pollution issues. Dr. DeBono has done extensive research on this topic. And, of course, we're delighted to have both Dr. DeBono and Ms. Witherspoon here with us this evening to share their expertise and their time. And so, without further delay, I'd like to introduce Dr. DeBono. Please welcome him with me.
Well, I wish to start by thanking Catherine Witherspoon for coming here all the way across the Atlantic from a very large country to a very small country. I'm only going to talk for a short while, so I can only scratch the surface of the problem, and it's probably better that way because it'll leave more time for discussion afterwards. I'll just be talking, giving you some facts just to put the matter into perspective. And then I'd talk about two things, two of my sort of worries, which are particulates and the possibility that there might be an increase in cancer cases in the coming years as a delayed effect of the pollution you're seeing now. And I hope this will give rise to some discussion, maybe, and I hope I'm wrong. Now, Malta would fit into the United States about 32,000 times, so we're talking about a huge country and a small country, but on the other hand, and a huge population and a small population. But if you take it in terms of per square mile, Malta has 3,300 people per square mile, and the USA has only 80 per square mile. Now, of course, a lot of those people are often concentrated in very small areas, but Malta, I think, can be looked at as one large town. You know, it is very densely built up. When you look at cars, if you look, it really it's the bottom line that counts, and we have about the same car vehicle ownership, shall we say, or people per vehicle, as the United States. But if you've got one line up to the middle again, you'll see that Malta has a huge amount of vehicles per square mile compared to the United States. This just about sums it up. You know, I was hoping to come here on a bicycle, but the rain was threatening, and I would have asked people, you know, put their hands up if they came by bicycle, but I'm sure no hands would have gone up. But the private car is, you know, the reigns supreme in Malta. It's the number one object of desire, and people like the adrenaline type of driving and the adrenaline testosterone type of car, you know, with the big cars, powerful things. And it's this is the one of the problems that has to be overcome, the total dependence on cars in Malta. And I don't know how much hope there is for plug-in cars, like electric cars, again, for the same reason that people like the power and the comfort of the gasoline car. If we go on a bit, I don't know how clearly you can see that. This, most of the population of Malta is concentrated around this area here, and this is probably where pollution is a problem. That's about one quarter of Malta, or one quarter. I'm not sure, but anyway, but it's a very large proportion of Malta that's built up, and also a lot of the areas have narrow streets which concentrate the pollution. So it is inevitable that people live near traffic and near main roads, and this probably doesn't help when we have pollution. Added to the pollution from traffic, we have our electricity generation. It's at the moment, Malta generates all her electricity from fossil fuel, and we have just a very little amount of renewable energy being used. This is mostly from photovoltaic panels on people's roofs, and it's insignificant so far. We have the sun and the sea, and but we aren't using them very much. The sun and the wind, sorry, we're not using them very much. Again, water is produced using electricity, which again in itself is another source of pollution. About 60% of our water comes from reverse osmosis, and the rest comes from the water table, which is being gradually exhausted. Carbon dioxide emissions. Malta has been asked to reduce her carbon dioxide emissions, it had asked for about 2,100 million or 2.9 million cubic tons of CO2, but the EU has asked Malta to decrease her, to keep it down to 2.1 million. Right. Now, we come here to the effects of pollution. I would guess that just in line with the rest of Europe, we all lose about between 3 and 8 months of life. Maybe us pensioners, old people like myself, are losing out months of happy pension because of a reduction. Statistically speaking, we all live 3 or 4 months less because of pollution. And this is another worry, is lung cancer. And I'm rather concerned that we might miss any improvement in lung cancer or decrease in lung cancer due to improvement in traffic conditions, although this will be delayed a long time. This will get kind of submerged in a change in the incidence of lung cancer from reduction of smoking. You know, so it, however, besides reduced life expectancy, we are likely to see more lower respiratory symptoms, and particularly asthma, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is not so important in Malta, but these will be aggravated. And another unknown thing, which I don't think has been studied, is that reduced lung function has been seen in children who were exposed over most of their life to pollution. By reduced lung function, what I mean is that their respiratory function is reduced by about 10%. If you take children who grew up or who are growing up in an area which is polluted, and you compare them to children who are growing up in an area which is not polluted, you do lung function tests, you'll find that the children who've grown up in the polluted area will have slightly impaired lung function. And this is manifested, for instance, at a simple level by an inability, by a lowered forced expiratory volume, which is the maximum speed of air or forced expiratory rate. The maximum amount of air they can inhale and exhale, and somehow their lungs seem to remain slightly underdeveloped. Well, there we are again. It's just put into numbers, and the impacts vary according to the pollution, and the impact is much higher in Belgium than it would be in a more sort of a less polluted area of Europe. These are the PM stands for particulate matter. Now, particulate matter is, I think, probably the most pernicious pollutant. It is very tiny particles, or they vary in size, but it's a small ones that are of importance, because when you inhale them, they go right deep into your lung. So the ones which have a diameter of 10 microns or less, a micron being a thousandth of a millimeter, then those will penetrate deep into the lung. And the tendency is for them to remain there once you've inhaled a particle, because when we exhale, our bronchial muscles contract, and the idea being that you expel anything that was in there, but if they're fine enough, they will not be expelled, and so they go in and don't come out again. Now, I won't go into these, because it's just, we've got the limits which have been set, and here we have probably the most polluted street in Malta, which is a shopping street. It's an uphill and it's a one-way street, and there's a lot of cars pass through it, and people get sprayed with exhaust from diesel buses, the old diesel buses, as they go up the hill. It's quite awful, really. Now, another thing is about particulates. In other words, particulates come out in the exhaust of vehicles, and particularly diesel vehicles, and if they are old and not well maintained, then you have that much more particulates. Another thing is that there's a sort of tendency to sort of gloss over, to poo-poo the question of particulates, and by saying that a lot of our particulates consists of sea salt. But if you look at the red line here, you will notice that there's a hump there and another hump here, and this coincides with rush hour traffic. And this is a very nice picture, and this was recorded on a very, very congested thoroughfare in Malta, leading into Valletta, St. Anne Street, to those who live here. So I don't think really sea salt would do that. So we do have a particulate problem in roads that are sort of carry heavy traffic. And also, I think another sign that the particulates, the sort of dust, is not salty, is that when we were young, if you did this and the dust was white, and now if you do that on a dusty surface, you get blackened fingers. So I think that we do have a particulate problem, and it's the one I'm sort of particularly worried about. Here it is, you see. So this is the observation that was made. Now, we are talking about a slightly coarse particulate. It's called PM10. Now, PM10 is 10 microns, but the really real bad one is 2.5 microns. It's one quarter of that size. Now, again, so a micron is a thousandth of a millimeter. So these are very, very fine particles, and you probably don't see them. I mean, what we see coming out of our buses is very rich in particulates, but the fine particles you don't see. And you also have many more particles per cubic meter, because they are that much finer. So if there are so many particles, if this is a weight, anyway, of particles, they'll be, if the finer they are, the more particles you have, numerically. This is just to show you where we have, among other places, where monitoring has or is taking place. This one is where the pollution seems to be very high, and it is also rather high in this area and in the Sliema area. And The monitor was set up in 2006, in June 2006, at a place called Emcida for Catherine Witherspoon. This is, I think, between two hot spots, but I'm told, and the data are not yet available, they're still available in raw form and rather indigestible, but I'm told that, again, we've had roughly the same results as were in found in this site here earlier. We have another one here, another monitor, and previously the findings were also of particulates and nitrogen and ozone were rather high. So, and again, you can see the density of building and urbanization in this area. And this is where most of the pollution will be found. The staying indoors does not protect you from particulate pollution. You get just as much inside in the home as outside. And we have evidence that there are higher incidence of asthma in children who live in places with heavy traffic. These are just, don't try to read this, they're just some of the references which show that living near a street is not, living near heavy traffic is not good for you. And among these we have also something from Malta here. There are other sort of other sort of surveys which have been carried out in Malta. Right, now this is another subject which is rather worrying. Cancer develops not at once. If you sort of inhale diesel for a day, you will not get it cancer immediately. It takes a long latent period for the cancer to develop. And a lot of the studies done, surveys which were done over short periods, would obviously miss out. They would not notice the cancer. However, there are studies which have shown this, and in particular the American Cancer Society study, which followed 500,000 patients, subjects for 20 years, showed that there was an increased incidence of cancer associated with living in polluted areas. Now, very much the same applies to nitrogen. High values were found in many areas. Basically, this just adds to the evidence that we have a pollution problem, but we haven't got the recent data are not available yet in analyzed form, and this may change. Maybe somebody in the audience during the discussion might have some more information on it. Now, what can you do? On one side, we can conserve or use less fossil fuel, and certainly in this, the question of transport, we have to use cars less, use bicycles more, use smaller cars when we use them, and then we should, there's energy efficient housing and reduction of wasteful practices, and again we were talking about this earlier, and it's education. We need a fundamental change in attitudes. And on the other side, we can exploit solar energy, wind energy, and biomass. Now, wind energy we are starting to explore solar energy by investing in photovoltaics on roofs, because you can connect it to the grid quite easily. Wind energy, we have a site here which was recommended as a site for a wind farm, and it's far away from inhabited areas, it's the far end of the island, and it's very near to the grid, which crosses from Malta to Gozo, but it hasn't materialized, so we haven't yet invested in wind energy. But the fact remains that we have too many cars and people are using them too much, even for leisure. And another imponderable is recreational craft. We have got more and more sort of cabin cruisers, and we have a lot of air transport going up and down on the island, which contributes. And there's something one could do here. Anyway, so maybe this is just a quick whistle stop tour.
I'm going to invite you, in advance, to come tomorrow to the University of Malta at lunchtime, because I'd hoped to get into part two tonight, but I don't think we're going to have time. After I tell you about the health effects of air pollution, which can be somewhat depressing, then to go into what we can do about it. But that is the focus of my talk in Malta tomorrow at the university. And so if you can't sleep tonight because you're worried about your lungs, all is not lost. And if you come by tomorrow, I'll tell you the other half of the story. But I had prepared an hour lecture for this time period, and I'll talk as fast as I can, but I don't know if we'll get through it all. I'm Catherine Witherspoon, but the whole purpose of the Air Resources Board, which has existed since 1968, is to protect public health. It's not social engineering. It's not whiz-bang technology. It's not wow, groovy hydrogen cars. It's to protect public health. And in California, and I think, given Dr. Bernard's talk, the health risks come from the same place they do in Malta, which is particulate matter, and we call particulate the pollutant of this century. We've sort of been taken aback and astonished and worried about how powerful particulate matter is in its effects on the human body. We've had a long-standing ozone problem, which is beginning to abate, and then indoor air pollutants are very pernicious as well. So when you look at effects on the human body, it's a complex five-part process where there's emissions at the first instance, and then they enter the air where they might be diluted, or they might chemically react in the atmosphere with other pollutants and create new compounds. They might stagnate and build up into larger ozone clouds. And then people come into contact with those pollutants, and these are subjects carrying portable air monitors. Then there is the effect on the lungs and other parts of the body, and then what is medically produced as a result of those pollutants entering the body. And I should also say, before I go any further, we use this to teach our incoming, they're not our anymore, I'm not still at the Air Resources Board, grew up there, to teach the incoming professionals about health effects. Because the people who work on air quality control are engineers, meteorologists, statisticians, physicists, and they don't all come with the same amount of information. And so we want them to understand what the agency is all about. So we run an air academy, and you're required to go when you come to work for the Air Resources Board, and this is one of several courses we give. I'm giving you a much shortened version. Here is a plastic cast of a human lung. It looks like a cauliflower. And on the right-hand side, the alveoli have been sort of pared away so you can see the branching structure. You've probably all seen this in human anatomy books. This is what we were just talking about, which is how as the branches reach deeper and deeper into the lung, and they're called generations from the top, the Z generation 0, 1, 2, 3 on down, and where the particles reach based on their size. And so ultrafine and fine particulate get all the way through the tract. Ozone, because it's a gas, penetrates down to 16, 17. Larger particles are stopped by the mucus in your nose and throat. So that's why the ultrafines are so dangerous. And then you can see on the slide on the right is the same sort of representation of how much mass gets passed into deeper parts of the lung based on its size. Okay, this is what it looks like without the alveoli pared away. And so these little grape-like clusters is where the exchange takes place in your lungs between oxygen and carbon dioxide. And the red bands in the airway walls are the muscle cells which control the diameter of the airways, and they contract in response to irritants, and they contract to expel the air. And that's called reflex bronchoconstriction. And they're hyper-responsive in people with asthma. So how do air pollutants actually harm your health? Inside your lung, there are nerve receptors that make airway muscle fibers contract when they're exposed to irritating substances. It's like when you go to the doctor's office and they hit your knee with a rubber mallet and your leg kicks up. So when an irritant hits your lung muscles, it sends a signal to the brain, and the brain sends messages back for the lungs to contract, or to your spinal cord. And so that means the airways become narrower and it gets more difficult to breathe. Now, all people don't respond the same way. Some people can breathe a lot of particles, doesn't bother them all. Other people are very sensitive, and there seems to be a genetic predisposition in who is going to be more sensitive than others. And we build our standards around the most sensitive individuals. So the graph on the right is a picture, and you can't see the color like it should look, of airways that have become inflamed due to ozone inhalation, and if they were not inflamed, they would look like a paler pink, like your gums. Okay, so these are the symptoms that when your bronchioles constrict, what happens, and you can feel these things quite obviously. You understand when you're suffering. What you're not as aware of is the inflammation response that's going on inside your body. And the way that air pollution researchers have learned about this is using fiber optic bronchoscopy, where you insert a tiny camera into the throat and put the tip in the airway and then inject sterile saltwater solution and then suction it back up and look at what's in that solution, and you'll see cells and fluid from the lung, and you count them on microscope slides, and you see the presence of biochemicals that were set up by this inflammatory response. And inflammation is starting to be attributed to multiple diseases, not just those set about by air pollution, but all kinds of ailments, Alzheimer's, fibromyalgia, of course, Parkinson's, you know, these different processes going on inside our bodies. And this has really been one of the big breakthroughs in the last 10 years, more knowledge about this inflammatory response and how it moves from the lung to the heart. Okay, so I told you that we build our standards based on who's most at risk. And so obviously elderly persons with any kind of heart or lung disease, asthmatics, there's an S missing, I apologize, infants and children who breathe more per body weight than we do, people who are outdoors all the time, or truck drivers. I mentioned cancer. The people most at risk for cancer from diesel exposure are drivers, train workers, et cetera, and athletes. But here's the thing. At any time in our lives, we're in one of these categories. So we're all vulnerable. Okay, so how do we know that adverse health effects are coming from air pollution? Some of you will take this on faith, and others of you will be very skeptical. So we have clinical exposure studies, and we actually hook healthy volunteers up to breathing devices, and some of the time there's no pollutants presence at all. We're looking for effects air pollution has already had on the lungs and whether they've lost lung capacity. Other times there is pollutants that we have these healthy subjects breathe, and there's ethical issues with that, of course. And then look at the endpoints after the exercise has been conducted. But you can't put people under exposure to really dangerous chemicals, things that might be carcinogenic, things that you can't find unless you do a biopsy after the experiment. So we use animal exposure studies to fill in and look for some of the same endpoints. And the advantage of this is that the tests run in more time. We can do multiple series of them. And then the difficulty is transferring what we've learned back to human anatomy. And is it in fact accurate? Also, the animals are dosed at very high levels, higher than you would ever encounter in society or even in industrial exposures. So there's issues about the relevance of the results. But this is where the identification of carcinogens comes from, and then other evidence about biomechanisms for human health. And then epidemiological studies are considered, in some respect, the gold standard because people believe you when you say you've followed hundreds and thousands of people and you've measured the results in actual human subjects. And you can look at death rates, you can look at hospital records, how often they go to the emergency room, how often they use their asthma medicines, and that sort of thing. But because you have people moving around society in real-world conditions, you can't control for every variable. You screen out smoking. You screen out occupational exposures. You identify access to health care and other things that might be perturbing your results. And they call them confounders. And there's a list of 40, 50, 60 that you need to address in your statistical analyses of results. And also, although it looks very direct, pollution, higher mortality, you actually have not physically demonstrated the cause and effect. You've demonstrated a very, very strong relationship, a consistent relationship all over the world, but, not in, injecting a person with particulate and that individual dying the next day. So the reason we call particulate the pollutant of the century, we used to be focused much more on ozone, and we were regulating particulate decades ago as a nuisance. And so we put bag houses on facilities, and we did dust controls at quarries and constructions, because people didn't want to breathe a bunch of dust. But we've come to find out, after we went through this lengthy process of analyzing diesel particulate especially and whether it was carcinogenic, that the effect of diesel on the human heart and on cardiac arrest was 10 times greater than its carcinogenic risk. And so midway through our toxic control program, we said, this is about mortality, and this is not about losing 3 months of life. The people who are affected by this cardiac impact lose, on average, 14 years of life. So they have a heart attack they otherwise would not have had because of the inflammatory response a day after diesel exposure. And we now believe that a quarter of the heart attacks experienced in California had an antecedent of particulate exposure. So it's not that more people are dying, it's that we have discovered what was the cause of their death after the fact. And you won't find death certificates that say died from air pollution. It was died from a heart attack. And, heart disease is the number one killer in America, and I assume it is in Malta, too. And so there's been endless research into the mechanism of the heart, and it's only been in the last 5 to 10 years that this link to air pollution and to particulate pollution has been found. Of course, we also see reduced lung function in children, and what that means is you get to your adulthood. When you're born, you're very fragile. Individual. And then as you develop and acquire immunities and other things, you become more robust. And through your early teenage years and your adulthood, you're strong and virile and all the rest of it. And then as you age again, your fragility comes back. And as you get into your 50s, 60s, 70s, depending on what kind of genetics you were born with, you're more vulnerable to disease. When air pollution is present, the whole curve shifts over. So you're vulnerable in the womb, and instead of being vulnerable at 50 or 60, you're vulnerable in your 40s. And so you're more likely to succumb to a lung disease that you would have withstood before had you not been exposed to air pollution all that time. I guess we've talked a little bit about what particles come from. They are emitted directly from sources like quarries, like construction, et cetera. And then they also form in the atmosphere from gases. And in California, it's the combination principally of nitrogen oxides with aluminum nitrate or aluminum compounds to become aluminum nitrate. And then also volatile organic compounds can condense into particles. And so we have a heavy loading from industrial activity and vehicle driving, and I presume you do too. But people don't understand that, and there's confusion about sea salt, there's confusion about dust, and what is what. But by far the most harmful is the combustion-related. And so here is some of what's in a micron or 10 microns of particulate. There might be metals in there, carbon, soot, salt, smoke, etc. How small is it? Hair in a cross section here is 60 microns across. So PM10 is the large orange, and PM2.5, which we call fine particles, that's how small this is. This is lung tissue from a 50-year-old. God, you cannot see this really well at all. It's so beautiful on my computer. Lung tissue from a 50-year-old non-smoker. And it's, you know, beautiful red and spots of black all over. A non-smoker. And you've probably seen dissected lungs of what smokers look like. Black, 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 black. Now, your lungs are unable to clear away this fine particulate as it collects, and you will not continue collecting particulate if you move away from polluted areas, so there can be regeneration in that sense. But the particulate exposure you have is going to be with you for your life. So the principal effect of long-term exposure is associated with premature death in older adults and with cardiopulmonary disease. And the reason we know that is there's been an enormous study of more than 500,000 adults in the United States over 16 years from 150 different cities, and then various reanalyses of this information to chart the effect of particulate exposure and then the response in death rates and the response in hospitalizations, et cetera. Now, this slide, at least you can see it, but what's on here are the cities that were analyzed, where P is Portage, T is Topeka, Kansas, W is Watertown. You won't know the names of these cities. They're sort of basic American cities, but what's most important is what we call a linear response, the diagonal line between all the cities. And so what that means is that as the micrograms per cubic meter of pollution rise, which they're doing across the bottom, the risk of mortality also rises. And this effect has been observed in city after city all over the world, in Greece, in Africa, in Scandinavia, in Brussels, etc. You see the same linear response. So do we have proof? Can we say you keeled over from particulate? No, but we have extraordinarily strong evidence that higher particulate in the atmosphere leads to dire consequences in human health. This study looks at it from another way, which is, what if you take the pollution away? Do the death rates go down? Well, yes, they do. This is a steel mill in Utah, and Utah is Mormon country, and Mormons don't smoke and don't drink. So, you know, they're a wonderful control population. And this steel mill closed right after the installation of a particulate matter network that had been mandated by federal law. And so we wouldn't have seen this effect if the monitors weren't there. And so the researchers went back and correlated the particulate readings with the hospital records and saw this tremendous effect that the blue is when they're open. Well, you can read it. Open, closed, reopened, and the health effects came right back. There have been similar studies around the world with a Dublin coal ban, with reunification in Germany, with a Hong Kong dramatic sulfur reduction. We call these intervention studies. You know, prove it to me. All right, here's your proof. Ultrafines are those particulate which are under 1 micron in diameter, and they can penetrate the very deepest recesses of the lung and cross the blood-brain barrier. And so we're very concerned about ultrafines and what's going on biomechanically and what is on those ultrafine particles as they get into your body. And where are they coming from? And I told you already that the fines, and this is absolutely true of the ultrafines, are coming from combustion sources. And they're also, because particles fall out, but ultrafines don't fall deposed to the ground as readily, but variolta fines, they go through different kinds of chemical agglomeration processes. So these effects are strongest immediately next to the source of emissions. So these effects are strongest immediately next to roadways. And we have land use guidance in California that says, keep people out of harm's way, move the houses, move the schools, move the hospitals back 1,000 feet from the roadways, or 300 meters. We're working on cars, we're working on fuels, we're going to make this problem go away, but it'll be 15 years before the vehicle fleet turns over. Get the people out of that zone. Use it for a parking lot, use it, you know, for light industry, put the access on the backside, put the ventilation on the backside, keep the people away from the street. Okay, ozone is still a problem, and these are the effects of ozone, which is an invisible, irritating gas in the atmosphere. But the effects of ozone in California, because we've been regulating it for so long, are a fraction of the effect of particulate. So really, we're finishing the job on ozone, but our attention has shifted almost completely to particulate. And then, I don't know that these units of measurement will mean anything to you, but when we set standards, we look at what level can we say we see no adverse health effects. So already in the atmosphere, there's 0.04 parts per million just from natural processes. Vegetation gives off precursors to ozone, and there's transport around the world. And so background eats up half of what is now the allowable level for ozone. And so we have to do extraordinary things to stay below that level. So here is a summary sheet of what we have identified as an effect of ozone or particulate and what we've quantified for California. And if we've quantified it, you can quantify it too if you have the data of where you have high ozone readings, where you have high particulate readings, and you can correlate it with your medical records. This is a monetization of what those effects mean. And in the United States, there was a value placed on life of roughly $8 million. Don't ask me why. It's the value that regulators use all across the country based on various kinds of statistical surveys of what would you pay to live longer, essentially. And so the impacts of air pollution, when they're turned into monetary terms, are completely overwhelmed by how much we value life itself. This is not money in your pocket. If we save these lives, the money doesn't come back into the economy. This is the value you place on being here to see your children graduate, get married, to meet your grandchildren, etc. Now, some of these are direct out-of-pocket costs, like what it costs you to go to the hospital, how long you're off work, and that sort of thing. We're also worried about indoor air pollution, because we spend most of our time indoors. And most the laws in California are about outside, but air moves freely through structures in and out. And over time, you have the same pollutants inside as you have outside, and you have additional sources inside. And because it doesn't move out as quickly, if a pollutant is released in your house, you're 1,000 times more likely to breathe it than if it was released outdoors. There's just so much more dilution going on outdoors. And so we've seen the same kinds of health effects inside, you know, asthma and allergies, carcinogenesis, premature death, et cetera, sick building syndrome, these new tight. We were asked by our legislature to identify what were the highest priorities, you know, what was causing the most stress to people, and what should we regulate first. And we said, get rid of those air cleaners that make ozone inside to sterilize the atmosphere. You are creating pollution inside your house. It's ridiculous, and sick people buy them, and they think they're doing something good for their families, and they are not. You're creating an air zone ozone episode indoors, so we have banned those in California. Mold, biological contaminants are a big deal. Building materials which have formaldehyde in them. When you burn things inside the house, there's combustion byproducts. So if you have gas stoves, gas-fired appliances, it's an issue. You mostly want the most efficient ones you can have and ventilation. We've identified environmental tobacco smoke as a toxic air contaminant, secondhand smoke. And radon, which is something in the ground that seeps up into houses, not such a big problem in California, more in the eastern states. And then what should you do to get rid of those sources? Is not get them in the house in the first place. And if they're in your house, ventilate and build the buildings properly. Costs and benefits. This is really important because we are spending billions of dollars in California to clean up air pollution, but less than a tenth of a percent of our gross domestic product. Our economy is $1.5 trillion a year. And we have gone back and calculated the effect of life saves for the dollars expended. And it's been $10 in health benefits for every dollar spent in the pre-90 controls. And now that we've moved into more expensive controls, which are diesel rules, cleaning up existing diesels on the road, not just what's rolling off assembly lines, which is cheaper to do, but going back and fixing the ones in service today, we're still running at 4-to-1 of return on dollars spent. So air pollution absolutely harms human health, causes great suffering, shortens lives, but there are an enormous number of technologies available to reduce those impacts, and we're quite happy to share them with the Maltese and with any other government that is interested in tackling this problem. And now there's time for questions and answers. Oh, yes, and if you want to follow up this research, this is courtesy of the California Air Resources Board, and they have a wonderful website and a public information office, and you can also talk to the individuals who are leading this research for California. And I'll leave this up here while we're doing Q&A in case you want to write any of it down. I think there's a copy of this slide, a copy of the whole presentation on this laptop now.
Yes.
Yeah. So whose laptop is this? You have it. So you can share this presentation with other people. It's on your computer.
Thank you very much. I'd be very obliged if you could leave them there, yes?
Yes, you have it.
There were one or two slides which particularly interested me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You'll also see the notes under them because the note pages are in here, too, if you bring up the notes page. Yes, in the back.
Okay, actually, we have campus radio here. This is a recording, and so we have a microphone here for your use. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ray Vassal. I'm an architect, and I take a keen interest in this aspect of pollution, especially if it's related to the traffic circulation. I'd like to give some information which complements what we've just heard from yourself and your predecessor. Maybe it's been mentioned already. I'm not sure because I was a few minutes late. But I'm informed that Malta has the highest incidence of asthma in children. I believe it's as high as 40%. And I also know that in 2001, the local council of a town in the south of the island, known as Vugra, commissioned a study which aimed to correlate traffic with disease in the area, in the local council area. In fact, two medical researchers were appointed to carry out the study, and they had access to data made available by the World Health Organization, which at that time was carrying out a worldwide study on the incidence of respiratory disease in all the five continents. And it resulted that in this town of Gugra, there was the highest incidence of respiratory disease anywhere in the world. I want to explain that Gugra is a corridor town. A lot of traffic passes through there on its way to other towns further south. But the situation is a bit confused because Vugra lies on in the direction of where the northwest wind might carry particulate matter from the power station in Marsa. So the situation has to be ascertained a bit more carefully. So that's as far as the health aspect.
Were you going to continue? Well, we found exactly the same thing in California. We have counties with asthma rates of 38% and extraordinarily high rates, higher than the rest of the nation, though we don't think it's all air pollution related, maybe a quarter of it on average. But we also have seen study after study and more being conducted all the time of asthma rates within the airfall of freeways. And there's a freeway running through the San Francisco Bay Area that's called Asthma Corridor in the vernacular of our newspapers, just like they call the Port of L.A. and Long Beach the diesel death zone, because they understand these effects. And health effects are written about in our newspapers every week. So our public is very, very aware of what's happening. And we see in study after study, the children who live under the gradient of the emissions that come off the freeway, and they're very high immediately next to the freeway, and then they go down in a bell curve till you're at background level at a, roughly 1,000 feet. And so at 500, you're somewhere in between. That they all have higher incidence of asthma and bronchial symptoms, and as do the elderly living in those areas. It's a terrible place to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to take up too much time, but I'd like to draw attention to another situation which is peculiar to Malta. And I want to say this in a constructive way. I don't want to criticize or offend anyone in particular, least of all the Minister of the Environment, whom I'm seeing here present. But it so happens that Malta tends to adopt policies, planning policies, that encourage more private car use at the expense of of public transport. And one case in point is parking standards. Malta is the only country in Europe which applies minimum parking standards, meaning if a certain minimum of parking space is not provided, one has to pay like a tax or a levy known as CPPS, which works out at about 3,000 euros per deficient parking space, so to speak. On the contrary, in the rest of Europe, a maximum standard is applied, meaning that if one exceeds that maximum, one is charged an ecotax. For example, in England, the standard is one car per residence. If you're not obliged to provide that parking space, but if you exceed it, you pay an ecotax, which is the contrary of what happens in Malta. I'm saying this with the hope that the authorities may take cognizance of the situation and address it.
Well, I'm hardly one to criticize car use because we love our cars in California, and we do a worse job even than Malta in that respect. And so we've put our faith in technologies, and the cars turn over every 12, 15 years or so. And you have much older cars here. But the other thing I want to tell you is that although traffic volume is the big indicator in these studies, a six-lane, a roadway or freeway, the single biggest determinant of how many health effects there are the number of trucks on those roadways, trucks and heavy-duty diesel vehicles of any kind. And so while I would be concerned about close proximity to car emissions, especially older car emissions, I think, you know, that's not the whole answer. And we are trying to keep people away from the trucks even more than from the cars. And those buses, I would agree. Riding behind a bus is the stupidest thing you can do on a bicycle. And the bus shouldn't be there, or you should take another route. It's terrible for your health. Yeah. Who's got the mic now? Down here.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for the presentation, both you and the first speaker. I'm actually Jason Bonich, and I'm one of the doctors who did the research study in Vgura and Zeytun. And I'm taking the opportunity not to go for the study, but to clarify some studies that have occurred that have been taking place in Malta, which sometimes are mixed together. There is the ISAAC study, which is the international study of asthma and allergies in children, which is done by a number of specialists in Malta, as and all over the world. And yes, there are hotspots, and this refers to children. And there are hotspots of asthma, of eczema, and of allergic rhinitis in different areas of Malta and Gozo. And that is what the first question was actually referring to. The study that me and my colleague did we already knew that Vgura had the highest incidence of asthma admissions in Malta. So we already took the health standpoint there and went to see if there is a correlation with ambient air quality. What we did find eventually in the first and the second study was that there is a relation, and this was mentioned by the first speaker, that the further you go from the main road, the less number of people with asthma symptoms there is in the Vgura area. Mm-hmm. What I would like to take the occasion to do is about the air monitoring system in Malta. It is still very primitive by what we actually need. If we are saying that the rates of asthma, allergic rhinitis, and eczema in children is high, and for adults, which was the study in Vgura and Zeytun, is among the highest in Europe, and it does not correlate with what other southern European countries are finding, then we really need a more sophisticated and a more widespread method of analyzing air quality in Malta. As far as I know, there are a number of fixed air stations. As far as I know, it is only three. And a number of diffuse tube analysis. And that's not really ideal. We need more. We need a higher network to be able to have real results because people are getting on the brunt of it. And one other thing is that it's a pity that I'm seeing the results of the first presentation. Those are dated 2004, and we are now 2008. When we did the study in 2001, we had to rely on the data of 1997, 1998, 1999. And then there was a promise at that time that this data would be available always online. And to this, to date, that has not occurred.
Error monitoring is hugely important because the monitors don't lie if you buy the right equipment and you keep them calibrated. But it's also very expensive. And you need technicians to go take care of them. And the particulate monitors, you need to collect the samples and take them to the laboratory and have them analyzed. One of the things we've done, because we're a huge state, to augment our monitoring network is we have mobile laboratories in vans. And so if it's beyond the capacity of government to permanently install monitors, you can set them up for months at a time in an area that you're concerned about and gather readings through that van and then move it to another part of the country and do a similar study. And so we have two or three of those vans equipped, and they're in service all the time. In different parts. So we do a refinery study, we do a port study, we do these asthma corridor studies and see what we pick up. In the way back in the sweater. You, yeah.
I think we all agree that no amount of technology will actually make up for the fact that a car, even an electric car, does produce pollution, if not at where it is driven, at the power station where the electricity is being supplied. We have to keep in mind that in Malta, we have practically no significant amount of renewable energy being generated at the moment, just an experimental solar panel here and there. But even if this were to be widely available, it would still cause a pollution cost. I mean, you have to manufacture the solar panels or whatever somewhere, and they won't last forever. So there's still an environmental cost in producing solar panels or whatever kind of renewable energy generator can be considered.
Just say quickly, I agree with you, the least polluting car is one that's never been built or one that's never been driven.
Exactly.
But absent that, a brand new gasoline car has cleaner emissions out the exhaust than go in the front through the radiator, and a new diesel with a particulate filter is fantastic. So if you can't go electric because you can't, you're right, your power system is bad and dirty, then change to new cars.
One other thing. What I am after is, and I believe that in Malta we really need a mental change. There's still this feeling that being able to afford and drive your own car is equated with a good standard of living, whatever that means. I live in Dingley, and it's supposed to be a rather clean air place, but over the past 5 years, I have seen a tendency for even full-time housewives to somehow find the money to drive their own car, and they don't drive it for out of necessity. Dingley is a really small village, and you get parents driving their own fully healthy children, they're not handicapped or with special needs or whatever, just to show off the fact that they have actually got their own car. Now, apart from the fact that they are depriving these children of healthy exercise and, you know, that kind of mental development that comes just by walking along a pavement, which may be uneven or whatever, children need that kind of stimulus to actually grow healthy. They cannot be driven all day long without suffering some sort of long-term effects, not just health-wise, I mean, even developmentally, even intellectually. So how has California tackled this kind of mental attitude in the sense that you actually market the idea that, hey, cars aren't all that they are cracked up to be. It's not healthy to drive as far as you can afford, so to speak. Even if you are a millionaire, you should not drive a car. That should be a last resort.
We are nowhere on that issue, nowhere at all, because we are very spread out, and only in San Francisco is it even conceivable to live without a car and rely on public transportation. Everywhere else, we do have in cities that are a little less dense, like just across the bay in Oakland, we have new share car programs so that you don't have to own a car, but you can go rent one for a day to do major shopping trips. or visit a relative or whatever it is you need to do when the transit's not sufficient. But we have not made any incursions at all in these attitudes. Though I agree with you, it's insane how many cars there are in Malta, and the old people are walking and the kids are driving, and it's small and it's not steep. You know, I was in Salima yesterday, and I thought, what are these people doing with these cars? And you know, I think here it would be easier than it is in California to do what Paris just did, which is drop 10,000 bikes at once on the streets, available to the citizens, and not an incremental program, not a small change of attitude, but take the bikes and go. And the bicycles had critical mass, and the cars gave way. So you can ride a bike around the Arc de Triomphe now. And I asked the kids, I've been lecturing at the university and at MCAS and the junior college, where are your bikes? And they said, it's terrible to take the bus. Have you seen our bus system? And, you know, I should have said, why aren't you protesting in the streets then to make the buses better? You know, some of them can't vote yet, but some can, and demand that you have superior bus service, because it's ridiculous, all these cars running around.
I make a suggestion here.
I would be just as happy to get rid of the SUVs in California, the sport utility vehicles, as opposed to get rid of all the cars. That would be a huge step forward for us.
I was just going to make a suggestion. Perhaps there are people in power who can make it happen. Could they please stop this kind of advertising for private car ownership, even at primetime television, even on bus monitors? You actually see adverts advertising private car use. I mean, it's so self-defeating.
You mean like banning tobacco advertising, which has happened in the past? It just takes the willingness to do it. I mean, you're voters, and you tell your government this is what you want. I don't think it's going to happen as long as we have capitalist society. But I told the kids, you know, I'd read on the internet, it's not hip to ride the bus. And I said to them, you decide what's hip. You're the young kid. You're the young people. You're the arbiters of hip. So if you make it hip, it's hip. You know, get on there with your iPods and your cool clothes and rock out and, you know, change the attitudes from the youth up. I really think we need to get the kids involved, because kids in America made their parents recycle. Kids made their parents quit smoking. You know, kids can be taught to unplug appliances so that you don't have vampire power. Kids say, Mom, can we have a hybrid when you buy your next car? So if there's more of these messages that the little kids get, they'll hound the rest of us, and as they grow up. And the eco programs in the schools are outstanding, where they learn about the carbon footprint of the school itself, and they undertake all these activities, you know, to win letters and flags, how much they can reduce their emissions. And I don't think it's propaganda. I think that it's, you know, sort of making them aware of something that we take for granted.
I don't know if President, there is someone from the ADT.
Earlier.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Vella. Because I've got to, I think I can make a suggestion or maybe ask a question. Nowadays in Malta we have bypasses, you know, not the main roads, bypasses outside the town and village cores. I don't know why buses still pass from the village core, where there is, as everybody has been saying, a huge amount of concentration of people living, you know, of houses there in the village, or, you know. Buses still pass to accommodate elderly people, I think, I don't know why, from the village core, from the main roads in the towns and villages. They don't go from the bypasses, you know, through the bypasses, which would help a lot, I think.
Are you talking about tour buses, or are you talking about the transit
about
buses?
About the transport buses.
Well,
transport
they need to come buses to the village and bring the people in. And take the people. They need to come into the village because that's where the people are going.
Well, in Malta, it's only two roads away, you know, two corners away from,
oh, I see.
From
okay.
The bus.
I see,
and
yeah.
You're thinking USA style.
Right.
I'm thinking about, I live in Paola, again.
Yeah,
I live
okay.
in Paola, which is adjacent to Vgura, where Dr. Bonici made his research. And again, another thing is that recently we had the very, very nice gift of having the incinerator. It was displaced from St. Luke's, and it was put in Barça, where they were adjacent, or even not adjacent, it is in the same place where meat from to all over Malta is being processed, slaughtered, and distributed, packed and distributed. So all the waste, all the
biomedical
waste, Dr. De Bono would confirm this, is being incinerated right in the middle of our meat processing facility. That's in Paula, in Marsa, which is, again, we're talking about 10 miles radius. So I live in Paula, so what I suffered, again, was my career, because every time I used to go to work, what Dr. De Bono, again, has mentioned was that eventually my house started to become a mini coal depot, because when you used to do this, it wasn't just white dust, which everybody doesn't take notice of, but it was carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon or charcoal or whatever. I'm not very scientific. So eventually I had to choose again and again if I was willing to live in a clean place, my house. Everybody likes to live in a clean house, or go to work, because I couldn't conciliate both things, you know. And this happened time and time again. So this is something which rarely is mentioned, that people who live in the Cotonera area, in the port area, Paula, Floriana, Vgura, those sort of places, the women especially, because we still have got this mentality that the bulk of housework is done by the women, suffer career-wise as well.
I think we have time for one more question.
I played about with George's figures, and I put the 0.3 cars per inhabitant into another perspective. It's 2 cars per household. The average Maltese household is about 2.9 persons per household. And we have about 2 cars per household, which basically means that both the husband and the wife have got a car, which is a horrifying statistic.
We have more cars in California than drivers. That extra is one. Different fashion, like a different purse, you take a different car.
What worries me particularly is that, given this horrific statistics, we still do not have, as far as I know, a transport policy, which means, like, where are we going to be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 20 years' time? Is there a target whereby we start to reduce car ownership by 10% in the next 2 years? There are absolutely no targets, which is horrifying. I was pleased with your cost-benefit analysis. And about 4 years ago, there was a seminar at the university to which I attended. It was about transport. And from the figures which were displayed, I made a quick calculation. Because the problem in Malta is we're just doing cosmetic changes to the public transport system, you know, getting bus drivers to not speak rudely or wear uniforms and these kind of real cosmetic policies, measures. But if one had to calculate the cost of transportation in Malta, whereby if we had to make a calculation on the cost of the amount of money going out from the country for the purchase of cars, we don't produce our own cars, so it's just money flying out of the country, spare parts to keep the cars going, fuel, which is, required to drive the cars, which we also import, the investment we need to keep the cars running in the roads, maintenance of the roads, the loss of environmental land, which is given up to widening of the roads or new roads. We've also got a problem with scrap vehicles, you know, at the end of the life. In Malta, there is no car recycling facility, so we end up with these cars, insurance costs, and whatever. And these are monetary costs, not costs which are attributed to health issues, which is another big cost. I had calculated it's more than 150 million per year, Maltese pounds. So if government had to stop for a second and assess what it's costing the country for not revamping the whole transport system, the money is there. Definitely the money is there. But at the same time, we hear year after year that there's not even money to replace the buses. There's a lot of money if one had to put in all these issues, apart from the health costs, which, I mean, the cost of running the new hospital in Malta is about 50 million Maltese pounds a year. That's about $150 million a year. And, of course, medicines and loss of production of workers falling sick because of respiratory disease and other stuff.
Well, stop. The way, you know, I appreciate all that you've said, except I've worked in government 26 years. The money people are spending on their cars is not government's money to spend. It's their choice of what goods they want to have. And so we're going to be far more successful if we make it easier for people not to use their cars, give them alternatives to the cars as opposed to taking car ownership away. Because I can tell you anyone who tried to do that in the United States would be voted out of office too sweet. But people, when presented with livable communities, walkable, bikeable communities, which we do not have in the United States, find that they prefer to be outside, they prefer to move around in other ways, they prefer to save money on fuel, and if our fuel costs got higher, we'd have a lot less driving than we have now. So I still think Malta, yes, should invest in transit, newer buses, better buses, more buses, and I think you should drop a bunch of bikes on the road and leave the car ownership alone for now, but let sort of the education take over, and people will get tired of this, you know, illusory power and prestige from gunning their vehicle up and down the streets of Salima. I mean, it's just silly.
Just two last points.
Okay.
George did not put scooters. I mean, you said that Malta is one big town, but funnily enough, we don't have scooters on the road, which is like commonplace in most European towns and cities.
Scooters are filthy. They're much dirtier than cars. Motorcycles are dirtier than cars. Motorcycles in California are dirtier than like 50 cars. It's because of the advanced technology that we've put on cars. They're far preferable to two-wheeled transport. And now the countries of the world that have little, you know, tuk-tuks and scooters and whatnot are having to go back and clear them away or change them to different fuel because they're, you know, just gross contributors to the pollution problem. Okay. So an electric scooter, go for it. An electric scooter.
last point. I made this an estimation. There's rampant illegal transportation of water in Malta. My calculation is about 5 million tons of water are transported every year from one place to another. I can readily accept that a bus which is providing a service, a social service, I can accept a certain degree of emissions from a bus. But to transport water which is illegal, and like 5 million tons a year is twice the amount of excavation and demolition waste we generate every year. So that's a huge amount. We know water is heavy. We've got all these trucks which have been, old trucks which have been retrofitted to transport water. And moreover, the activity is illegal. So it's about.
Where are they taking the water to?
Just from hotels and fields and industry and wherever.
I don't think that air pollution has been taken very seriously in Malta. I'm presently unemployed, and I was talking to the employment agency and even to a parliament minister once, and they told me, no, you cannot deny a job if that job is in a main road because of air pollution. You simply can't do it. I don't know. I would like to ask why no audit is being done on buses, because I'm the exception, I suppose, a bit of a freak, because I use exclusively public transport. I refuse to drive cars. I use them every day. Today it has taken me over an hour to go from Arendi to Valletta, which should take 20 minutes, but the amount of cars and traffic jams was incredible this morning. I don't know why nobody is really, really checking buses. Some of them, the emissions are horrible.
They are horrible.
And I'm not a scientist, but, you know, from what I see coming out, I can make a good guess. One final comment I would like to make is that this is the latest research. In Holland, it has been found that even 1 hour, we're not talking about a lifetime here or 20 years, 1 hour alters the brain chemistry negatively. I have a report here that was published in the media. I can give it to the panel if there is a copy. 1 hour, 1 hour, between 30 to 60 minutes.
Have news reporters in the room? Anyone who writes for print media, or there was a TV guy here earlier. In answer to your question, when will they do something, is when the public knows enough to ask for it. And in California, because we could see smog in the 60s, you know, that's when these programs were born, and everyone in California was an environmentalist because you could tell your own life was at stake, and California figured out air pollution because it had to, and it still has to. We have very severe inversions. So we don't pollute more than the rest of the U.S. We pollute a lot less per person, but it's held down against the ground and hemmed in by mountains, and it can't escape. So we have to have a fraction of the emissions the rest of the world can have before we go over standards. But what we do is we continue to publicize, and our newspapers pick it up, and the television picks it up, the things we're learning about health effects. So 80% of Californians understand what air pollution does to you, and 80% of them demand clean air. And so whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, you know, we don't have the Green Party, but, you know, anything in between, you have to be an environmentalist in California or you don't stay in office. And when your public becomes as educated about air pollution, and when your newspapers cover it and your television cameras cover it as regularly, then the politicians will respond, because they are intuiting what you want. They are intuiting what you will consent to. They are intuiting what you will demand of them and trying to give it to you. And so if you don't express yourselves, we want clean air, we want these filthy buses gone, they don't know. And, you know, they're not going to spend political capital because it costs money. They might have to nationalize the bus service given the EU directives about you can't subsidize. You know, in the U.S., the federal government pays for buses. And so they turn over every 12 years. And because they're owned by government, you can experiment with alternative fuels. You can slap on control technologies that might not work. And if it doesn't work, you know, nobody gets fired. You try something else because it's all government. But here, I understand the bus owners own the bus like a cab driver owns a cab. I've never seen such a thing. So have a medallion system, and you can't have a medallion unless you upgrade your bus. But that takes, you know, that takes courage and political action and people standing next to the politicians and saying, we'll leave you in office if you do this thing, because you know what the bus drivers are going to do.
My name is Gordon Knox. I'm a geologist. Thank you very much for both your presentations, but what struck me that they both rather dealt with indigenous sources, so, you know, what's being created here. Now, in Malta, particularly in the summer, the days can go extremely yellow, it gets very hot, and there are massive dust storms, which if you look on the satellite images, cover vast areas. Now this dust can... they carry an enormous amount of particulates. They can carry in a teaspoon anything from a million to a billion organisms, of which around about 30% can be not very nice for health, not only for humans, but animals and also agriculture. And there have been examples where I think one African dust storm dumped mercury on the Azores in the year 2000, where it had picked it up from mining activities. Now, in California, you've got a big sea in front of you, but here, these dust storms are extremely frequent, and I just wondered to what extent they do contribute to the problems here, as opposed to the indigenous sources, and what do we know about them?
Do you know? I don't know the answer to that question.
Maybe I can answer.
Yeah.
One of the problems with particulates emanating from fossil fuel combustion, it's more toxic. It, you know, the carbon,
yes,
particles absorb lots of nasty things, and these are very harmful. And they are also much finer, so maybe the dust you see is larger particles, which might not penetrate so far down into the lung. Whereas the pounding, you know, with each bang in the cylinder of an internal combustion engine, gives you very fine particles. And at the same time, there's a lot of chemistry going on in that cylinder, and that, you know, gets onto the carbon particle.
That's an excellent answer. I mean, I put dust in the nuisance category, and you certainly are driven inside, and you don't want to breathe in vast amounts of dust, and it can harm you quite a lot. But over time and time again, I mean, it's the world we live in. It's a small planet, and there's persistently organic compounds coming in. There's jet-level transport, you know, dropping in. And from time to time, the politicians get all excited and say, it's not us. Let's go after China. Let's go after Africa. Let's go after it. And it's ridiculous because there's so much local pollution being generated and being breathed immediately next to the roadways. So that's what we need to do first. And then we take our issues about international transport to international tribunals, and we work out aid packages and help them cope with these problems, help them revegetate so that we're not a victim of the Chinese dust storms or African dust storms, but it's really not the number one health assault in most countries. It's just not. Well, in California, it's trivial. When we get incursions of pollutants, we can measure them in our highest peaks, and on that day, it might show up as a significant fraction, but day in and day out, it's local pollution that's driving what we're seeing on our monitors and what people are breathing. So it's there. It's just like background pollution is there from vegetation and, you know, natural processes. It's always there. And so we always identify it in our air quality plans. You know, some people want to throw up their arms. Well, it's all biogenics. Why do we even try? Well, because we can, and because people are still suffering. And because we're getting a return on our investment, so there's a reason to push forward on pollution controls, even if the dust will still come.
Maybe I can add a few pieces of information. I'm Martin Sekel, Director of Environment Protection at MEPA. First of all, thank you, Ms. Witherspoon, and also to FA for organizing this lecture. A couple of points I picked up, which may be to clarify, starting from the point raised by the gentleman here. We've been running a network of monitoring stations for quite some time. And clearly, yes, there is a significant impact from traffic. That's clearly the number one source, also from power generation. But, of course, you do have these natural episodes, which are quite significant. There are two main ones. There is the issue of Sahara dust, mm-hmm. which is, of course, dependent on the meteorological conditions, but quite significant certain times of the year. And there is also the salt spray issue, which is there as well. Now, of course, granted, these will not have the same health impacts as the particulates from combustion. But you do have to look at the relative strengths, and it complicates the equation because you have to take them out of the equation to look at the other causes. So very often, for example, if you have a peak on particular days, first of all, you have to try and estimate what proportion of that peak will be coming from these natural sources. And it's not just natural sources. We have transboundary. Although Malta is an island, it may surprise many people. For example, our most sensitive air monitoring station is situated in Gozo. We placed it there to monitor the transboundary effects. And we already know, for example, ozone is being, the ozone we are measuring in Malta, a large portion of it is coming from chemical reactions in the atmosphere from pollution generated in Sicily and the oil refineries at Augusta.
I believe it.
That is, and that's something which we'll also be taking up with the Italian government, because the European Union directive requires member states to cooperate on transboundary effects. There's also the maritime traffic. The channel between Malta and Sicily is one of the busiest maritime channels in the world, particularly for supertankers.
And we measure maritime activities 40 miles offshore as reaching our landmass.
40 miles, almost Sicily. So, mm-hmm. And considering the volume of traffic which passes through that, it's
right.
The gentleman, the doctor, mentioned the issue of the monitoring network. First of all, we have five monitoring stations, real-time monitoring stations, and these have been set up on the basis of criteria which are established in the EU Air Quality Framework Directive. Now, the reason why the directive standardizes the criteria of how many stations you should have and where you should place them is, of course, for reasons of benchmarking, because the directive is applicable in all 27 member states, and you do need to have a benchmark if you want to realize whether you're getting somewhere or not. And the directive on air quality at the European Union has the concept of what it calls an agglomeration, which is roughly equivalent to 250,000 individuals, and roughly should have a monitoring station for each agglomeration. Now, of course, in Malta's context, it would have been two stations. We have five. But, of course, adding more monitoring stations will not really give us more information, because we already know what the problem is. The problem is mostly traffic. And therefore, I think the issue is, should we spend more money on zooming in on the detail, with, of course, the running costs of maintaining this equipment? I have next to me our only expert who is able to maintain all these stations. And it's a full-time job to keep them and to verify the data and so on.
And I would say it depends on what do you need to convince the politicians.
Yes. Well, we have the data. the issue is, and this is my last point mm-hmm. I wanted to make. It's all about the public willingness to change. I will give just one example. If people have been talking about the need to invest in public transport and so on, and I suppose we could. For example, it could be possible to change the entire fleet to gas, for example, which mm-hmm. would make an instant improvement in the quality. But of course, as you rightly point out, it's a private-owned fleet, and therefore it's not so straightforward. But there are other issues. I mean, people may have noticed the last few days that the price of diesel has now, for the first time, exceeded the price of unleaded petrol. And that seems to be a trend which probably will continue. Now, we'll see whether that will actually translate into a shift. There are already some signs that there is some disquiet from the public and from the business sector in particular, who are heavy users of diesel. But of course, this, I think, is something which is quite interesting. Because if this trend continues, it should influence the decision to purchase new vehicles. And also, we have the problem here in Malta of a very, very old-aged fleet. It takes far too long to get the newest standards, especially for diesel, where there's a thriving second-hand market, to get them on the road.
Over lunch, there was a conversation we're having at the Ambassador's House about banning the importation of old used cars. So that, and also schemes have been tried around the world where after a certain age, and I think Singapore does this, you can't register your car if it's more than 10 years old. It's just got to go.
Unfortunately, under European Union law, it would be impossible because although you could perhaps ban direct imports from third countries, even if the WTO would mm-hmm. allow you to do such a thing, there would be a very simple bypass. People would just import them into Italy and just ship them over, and you could do nothing because it's the internal market. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, we have to play by the rules which the EU sets in this respect. But I think the answer is actually this, and this is maybe the most uncomfortable answer. I'm speaking personally now, not in my capacity as Director of Environment Protection, but I think the only way to affect consumer behavior is through a fuel tax. It's only when you make fuel uneconomical that people will look for alternatives. Otherwise, you can invest all the money you want, but people will still use the fuel. And I think that's something which maybe the country needs to start thinking about at some point.
You know, of course, our thanks, the U.S. Embassy, as well as Flim Kingal, Ambient Air, would like to extend our thanks both to Catherine Witherspoon and George De Bono for their time being here today. And we would also like to thank all of you for coming as well.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Flimkien Alambiyan Tahyar entitled Air Pollution and Its Effect on Human Health.